incomprehensible to graduate students, but at least the first student, I'm going to attempt to do that, but yeah, I'm probably just taking it out. Or to consider a piece of layer out of the timeline for it. This is a funny lemma of linear algebra, which plays a key role at the end, and I know a couple proofs of this, and I know some different ways to state it, and I'm interested in knowing more proofs of this and more ways to think about it, because I think there's something quite interesting happening here. You start with a vector space, which is the direct sum of some subspaces, and the sum ends are indexed by a cyclic group of even order, so Z mod 2AC here, and eventually they'll all have the same dimension, but right now let's just say that the dimension of one of them is odd. And on this vector space, we give ourselves a pairing, which is non-degenerate, and either symmetric or skew-symmetric, the sort of two separate statements here. So this, for once, one chosen epsilon, this is true for every pair of vectors, V and V prime. And I forgot to put something here, namely, if I take a couple of these spaces, Wi and Wj, and pair them together, usually I will get zero. And this is going to be not zero if and only if I is equal to J plus A. So the I and J look at this cyclic group of order 2A, so they're at opposite sides of this circle. They pair non-trivially, and all the other pairings are zero. Okay, and then the last piece of structure is the linear transformation from V to V, and it should permute the spaces cyclically around the circle there, and it should preserve the form. And the conclusion of all of this stuff is that this polynomial, 1 minus epsilon t to the 2A, where epsilon was the sign here, the pairing, divides the characteristic polynomial of G acting on V. Okay, so you can take that as an exercise and get bored listening to me. It's very easy if this dimension is 1. So you can think about a higher dimensional space here. That's when it gets a little bit more interesting. It's not tremendously difficult, but it plays a key role in what I'm going to say. Okay, so I think that was understandable for graduate students, right? I'll keep going in that vein for a minute. So I'm going to fix a field K, which later will be a function field. I'm going to take a curve C. So an algebraic curve over K. As in Bjorn's talk, this will be smooth, projective, and geometrically irreducible. And I want to consider a function on this curve. So F is an element of the function field of this curve. So this is a paramorphic function, if you will, on the curve. And if I have a point in the curve, then this data leads to an integer, which is the order of vanishing at this point, order of vanishing or pole of the function. So this is an integer, which measures whether or not the function vanishes, if the integer is positive, or has a pole, if it's negative, at the point p. And of course, this is zero for all but finitely many p for a fixed f. Okay, and you package this data together by, given an f, you make the divisor of f, which is a formal sum over all the points on the curve of the order of vanishing of your function at that point times the point. So it's a z-linear combination of points on the curve. It's a finite linear combination because there are only finitely many points where a given function has a zero or a pole. And one fact that you know about this, two facts, is first of all, the degree of this thing is zero, which means that if you just sum the coefficients without the formal p's in front, okay, that's the familiar statement that a function has as many zeros as poles on a Riemann surface if you count it with multiplicity. And the other important fact here is that if you have two functions, f and g, and they have the same divisor, that happens if and only if the functions are multiples of one another. Lambda is some element in my ground field is zero. Of course, the original function here was not supposed to be zero either. Okay, so that says that a function on a curve is characterized by its divisor. If you know where it has zeros and poles, then you know the thing up to a scalar multiple. So it's natural to ask for the converse of that, namely, can I specify this thing arbitrarily subject to this degree equals zero condition? Okay, so can we... we find a function f with a given degree zero divisor. Okay, so if I write down a linear combination of points, coefficients add to zero, I can ask, is there a function that vanishes to the order specified or has a pole to the order specified at each point on the curve? And of course, most of you know the answer is no, but sometimes it's yes. So it's yes if your curve is isomorphic to P1. We used to teach this calculus in some form. If you know the partial fractions algorithm, then you know how to write down a function on a Riemann sphere that has a given set of poles and zeros. And in fact, this is the only case where this happens. So there's a group that measures the failure. So this thing is sometimes called Picknock. of C, and this is the group of divisors of degree zero. Let's write down here. The formal linear combinations of degree zero modulo of the divisors of functions. And that's a group that's attached to any curve over any field. It's a basic invariant for the curve. It somehow measures how complicated the function theory of the curve is. And it turns out that there's a variety. There's a g-dimensional inductive variety called J of the curve, the Jacobian, so that the rational points on this guy, coordinates of K, are exactly this group. And those are the varieties I want to study in this talk over special fields. Before doing that, I want to consider what this picture looks like over C, where we can get some feeling for what J should, how we should think about J. Okay, so let's consider the case for K equals C. So my curve is a Riemann surface, and we can get a very nice description of this J by doing line integrals on this surface. So let's fix holomorphic differentials, one forms. Did I say dimension G here? Yeah, G dimensional. So I didn't say G before. G is the genus of my curve. So if you don't know what that is, it's that dimension. And it turns out that the space of holomorphic differentials is G dimensional. So I fix a basis omega 1 up to omega G. And then I want to define a function on points and then a function of divisors. So we fix a basis in the space of holomorphic differentials, and also a base point in my curve. So here's my base point P0. And I want to define a function of a point, which is take a line integral from P naught to P, and these guys make a vector like this. So I goes from 1 to G. Okay, so I have some variable point here, and I choose a path from here to here, and then just do a line integral on the surface. Okay, so this gives me a vector of numbers. And, of course, it's not at all well-defined, because there's a choice of path here. I could have, instead of going this way, I could have gone around this way, or maybe wound around in some other way. So there's some ambiguity here, and that ambiguity is measured by integrating these differentials over closed paths. Okay, so this is not well-defined. Because of the choice of path. Okay, well, it turns out that it is well defined if I model out here by some lattice lambda. And how do I define lambda? So we choose basis, say, gamma 1 of the gamma 2g of the one dimensional homology of my curve, integer coefficients. And then lambda inside CG is a subgroup generated by vectors integral over one of these paths, omega gamma j, of the I differential. So I can do that for each I one up to g. That gives me a vector in CG. And then I take all of those and then take the group generated by them. So that turns out to be a lattice. So this is the lattice of periods. And I get a well-defined map and curve into that thing by integrating over paths. So let's see, I want to say that the lambda must be PG generated by star sub J. J goes from 1 to G, and it's a theorem, it's not a triviality, but it's not incredibly hard, but this is actually a lattice. In other words, it's a free group of rank 2G inside here. This turns out to be a lattice. Okay, and so I get a well-defined map now. There's still a little bit of ambiguity in this base point, but I'll ignore that. From my curve, into this quotient of a g-dimensional complex vector space by a lab. So this thing is a torus. We know how to think about that, at least in dimension one. And that's what the points of J are going to be. Okay, so let's extend that map. And the map above two divisors. By sending summation of coefficient times p to a vector whose entry in the ith place is the sum of p, just the coefficient times the integral p of p. Fine. And then you do this by this up to g. Okay, now it turns out that the dependence on the base point is gone because the sum of the APs is equal to zero. So you can rewrite these integrals in terms of just closed things. And so we get a map, we get a well-defined map. And that goes from the divisors of zero on curve to this CG on lambda. Okay, well, the thing you're interested in was the pick not, or the parentheses, the divisors at the free zero modulo. The principal one said a classical theorem, two classical theorems of Abel and Jacobi say that this is an isomorphism. Okay, so the complex points, so J of curve, the coordinates against C, is this thing, and that turns out to have this very concrete description as a g-dimensional space module less. Okay, so this will be useful for us later to think about these things in a more abstract setting. I wanted to kind of go into the details there. Okay, so now I want to consider a different kind of field. Okay, so now let's consider K finitely generated over its prime. That might be a finite field, it might be a number field, it could be a function field over a finite field or a number field, it could be the ring of functions on a variety of finite dimensions over a finitely generated field. So this is a fairly general class of fields. And there's a theorem of Lang and Neron, continuing the work of Morneau Bay, which says that for a curve C over such a K, this is picked on, so it's divisors of degree zero modulo something. So this is a group, and this turns out to be finitely generated. So it's a finitely generated Abelian group. This is a familiar theorem in the case of elliptic curves, curves of genus one, then it albeit is, at least if you have a rational point, is the curve itself. And many of us know how to prove that thing is a finitely generated Abelian group, and this continues the same techniques. Okay, so the theorem that I want to sketch a proof of is an instance where these groups can be very large. So this is a vague version. I'll give you a more precise one in a minute. So the theorem is that for every prime p and every integer g bigger than or equal to 1, there is a curve C over field F, P, T. So these are rational functions in one variable over a finite field. That's the field of the type we're discussing over here. With this J of C coordinates in K. This is one. So this is K. And T. I'll slip up here and then it's called K now. With this thing, arbitrarily large range. Okay, so I compute this finitely generated Abelian group and assert that if you give me a rank, I'll give you back a curve which has rank bigger than that for the rank of its rational points in this Jacobian. And the examples are completely explicit. They're actually just
curve of genus G.
Curve of genus G. Thank you. You don't need to say anything else. Okay, so these curves are completely explicit. Now, for example, if P does not divide 2G, 2G plus 1, then you can take for your curve, the hyperlinked curve y squared equals x to the 2g plus 1, x to the 2g plus t to the p to the n plus 1. So this guy has the rank, sorry about this getting a little crowded here, Jacobian. Now let me drop this curve from now and just write j of k, bigger than or equal to p to the n minus 1 divided by okay, and there are similarly explicit equations for other combinations of P and G.
Are you also saying that given a rank, you can find the curve of that exact?
No, I'm not saying that, actually. I don't know whether that's true. I guess it is, but I certainly don't know for that. I just find something with a bigger rank. So here, I mean, this is all I'm going to say about the rank, is that it's bigger than something. So in many interesting examples, if you allow me to expand the FP to maybe something like FP to the 2n, then I can tell you exactly what the rank is.
Are you also going to make any claim about these curves, whether they're being non-constant? Or
yeah, I'm going to make a very strong claim about that. That's why this is the vague version of the theorem, and then there's going to be much more precise version that tells you that these examples are definitely non-trivial. So Bjorn's question is, well, maybe it happens that, you know, the Jacobian of this thing is really defined over some very small field, or maybe it's an elliptic curve with high rank plus some other garbage and all the rank is concentrated in the elliptic curve and you're just getting the same example over and over. Those things are definitely not trivial. And they're going to be non-constant in a very strong sense. Okay, so I want to sort of sketch the how you prove this. Sketch, definitely being the word. And eventually write this piece of linear algebra, which is now hiding behind the board. And I need some more technology to do that. So I want to go back to my Jacobians over C. And I want to talk about I'll drop the curve from now and just write J. So we know that J implicitly this curve around this Jacobian is this guy. So we said that J of C we could realize as CG modulo is free of the inverse lambda on rank 2G. And, this is a simply connected space, and this is a nice group vacuum in a fixed point free way. So we can conclude from this that the fundamental group J of C is this guy lambda, canonically equal to that. And H1, J with coefficients in Z, well, that's the abelianized by one, which is already abelian, so we get an isomorphism. Okay, and I want to just think about this a little bit using universal coefficients. That implies that H1, J, C, coefficients in Z mod NZ, well, that's isomorphic with lambda mod N, lambda, which I want to write in this perverse way as 1 over N times lambda divided by lambda. So here I'm thinking of lambda sitting inside CG, and I can, you know, take all those elements such that when I multiply by n, I land in the lattice. So this is, again, this is a bigger free group of rank 2g, and this quotient is z mod nc to the 2g. Well, when you write it like that, though, you realize something interesting, because this is exactly the points on C that have order n. Okay, so an element of cg, this natural group structure, cg mod lambda has order n, it can be multiplied by n, gets into lambda, so it's exactly an element here. And I guess the last thing I want to say, I'll just pull out of my hat, is that by general principles, you should expect that H1 of the curve, with the coefficient of Z mod NZ, is the same as H1 of the Jacobian. Or you can compute this directly and see that it's isomorphic to this guy. Now, the point is that the thing over here makes sense algebraically. I have any field whatsoever, I can form the Jacobian, and then I can ask about the points of order n. So I'll just take this equation as a definition. Okay, so that's the upshot. The right-hand side here is an algebraic object. so for any k, any curve over k, the type we've been talking about, we just define h1c, c mod nc, v, take the Jacobian, take the points in k bar, actually we want to be sure to have plenty of them, and then take those guys which are ordered. And here, the technical thing, I want to assume that the characteristic of k does not divide.
Yeah, this doesn't give the right answer.
Okay, and then finally, this is nice. I'd really like to be able to put a z in here, but I can't recover algebraically. That lambda somehow is a covering of something of infinite degree. So I want to have some characteristic zero coefficients to be able to do things like trace forms. So I'm going to have to take an inverse limit. So we fix some prime L not equal to the characteristic k. Move forward. Cl, which is just defined to be h1c c mod. It's defined to be an inverse limit. And also h1cql is. Okay, so maybe it's not, if you haven't seen this before, it's not tremendously important to follow every detail, but the idea is that by some kind of algebraic maneuvering, we can define something, some kind of a homology group for our curve, which in the complex place gives us back a close relative of the usual homology, and makes sense in a very general context. And before the experts jump on me, the notation here is overly simplified and non-standard. So there should be some bars or some cross k-bars and things like that. And I'm going to commit even worse crimes of that type as we go on. Okay, the other thing about this homology theory that we have put together here is that it has more structure than the usual homology because the Galois group operates here. So elements of these finite layer homology groups are points on the Jacobian coordinates in k-bar over n. I can take an element of Galois k-bar over k and apply it to those points and get another one. So the j is defined over k. The new point will satisfy the equations again. Okay, so this is an extra structure which is tremendously important. So Gal of bar over k acts linearly on this group h1cql. Okay, so you get a representation now k bar over k is the GL spectrum space. So should have said it over here. In this description up at the top, you see that this rank is z mod nz to the power of 2g. And it's not obvious, but that turns out to be true here. So this is isomorphic just as a vector space, the ql to the power of 2g. Okay, so I get a map from the Galois group into a matrix group, 2 by 2, 2g by 2g matrices with ql coefficients if you want to choose a basis. And it turns out, actually, we'll need this later, that this actually factors a group isomorphic to a symplectic group of size 2g. Okay.
GSP,
thank you. Yeah, I'm also going to twist here in a minute and the g will go away, but you're absolutely right. Okay, have I fulfilled my obligation to the graduate students program?
That's a dangerous question.
What's that?
That's a dangerous question.
Yeah. I'm sure it's the question. I like to do it dangerously. Okay, so one of the big ideologies in this subject is that this representation knows a lot about the curve. And I'm going to give two examples of that. So we get this representation of mean by rho. So rho is generally believed to know a lot. About our curve. Over the base of k. So here's an example which is, I think, justifies this belief. Let's suppose that k is a finite field. And that certainly makes sense here. Well, then this Galois group we all know is z hat. It's a procyclic group, sort of topologically generated by one element. So the data of this representation is simply one linear transformation. So now,
multiple disease. And so row amounts. One linear transformation is the basis of it. And in fact, which is proven essentially in this form by A, is that rho of the Frobenius, that Frobenius is the generating element of this rho-cyclic group, knows the number of points on the curve over, say, k prime, for all finite extensions. Of our finite. Okay, so if you can compute this matrix, then you can compute the number of solutions to the equations defining this curve over every finite extension. I think that qualifies as knowing a lot about the curve. Okay, so I want to continue with this ideology and explain now in a case when k is a somewhat more complicated field of context in which a way in which this row is supposed to tell you something about the curve. In particular, it's supposed to tell you the rank of the Jacobian variety, the rank of the group of rational points. Okay, so let's now suppose that K is global. A global field, that means it's either a number field or a finite extension of Fp of t, so a function field of a curve over a finite field. Okay, then from rho, you can form an L function. So it's given by a pretty scary formula. So you take a product over all the places V of your global field, and here you put the determinant, 1 minus a number, QV, this is the number of elements in the residue field raised to the power minus S, and then rho of Frobenius of V acting on the space of our representation here, so it's H1, C. Well, this would be defined in general, so I have to take some invariants under an inertia group, and then take an inverse here, and I believe that's it. So, an ugly formula. It's supposed to remind you a little bit of the formula for the Riemann zeta function, where this would be a one-dimensional vector space. You have a trivial representation. You just have the product of 1 minus p minus s over all primes p. So this is, I'm going to define to be the L function of the curve C, over my global field K, which I'll omit, complex variable S. And the thing to take away from this is that it's some Dirichlet series, which is formed from the eigenvalues of all the operators that you get from your representation by applying it to various Frobenius elements. So it's kind of a complicated thing to do, but it turns out to be very interesting. Okay, so when does this make sense? So that the product converges. That product defining this thing converges for real part of S greater than 3 halves. And it's expected to have a meromorphic factor, usually holomorphic. All S, C, and satisfy a function. Satisfy a functional equation. Relating LCS and LC. Okay, that's generally conjectured. And this is known in some important cases. So this is known if, the curve is 1, or if the ground field is Q, and the genus C is the most 1, or if K is equal to a function field. Okay, this case, if it's an if you haven't seen this before, go home and figure out why this is true. This just basically you have a couple of Riemann zeta functions around. This is Wiles and a whole lot of stuff before that.
and after that too, and the whole machinery. And this is from the 70s, basically. It's the Grundy analysis of Elkhorn. Okay. And I don't think there are very many cases. There are some other cases over number fields where this can be checked, but not very many. No general. Okay, so I brought up this L function to illustrate again this point that rho is supposed to know a lot about the curve, and there's a conjecture about that. So the first point is the Dirac conjecture here. It says that if you look at S equals 1, this L function, so provided that it does in fact meromorphically continue to the plane, you can ask about its order of vanishing or pole at this point. And the conjecture is that this is supposed to be equal to the rank as a group, rank of the free part of the points on the Jacobian with K. Okay, so it's somehow the order of vanishing of this function knows about the complexity of the function of the curve. Okay, so I think that's a pretty more precise version of the theorem. Okay, so here's the theorem again. So again, for all p, all g bigger than or equal to 1, there is this curve, c, genus g over p, such that three things are true. This BSD conjecture is true. Two, the order, the thing that appears on the left of that conjecture, or at one, LCS, is bigger than or equal to any. So you give me an R, and I give you a theorem that says this. And three is that the image of this representation rho, K bar over K, where K is this guy. So this goes into GSP2G. QL, and the image of this is large. Okay, so that answers Bjorn's question in some sense, because this says that the fact that this has a large image says that this Jacobian cannot be broken up into smaller parts. It's simple, even over K bar. It doesn't have any factors. Even if you make extensions of K, you can't find any factors defined over small fields. It's sort of a very irreducible object. Okay, so that's kind of a technical thing. The order of vanishing of the L function large and the fact that the conjecture is true gives the theorem that I stated before, and the rank of this group is very large. So the proof goes like this. It doesn't actually construct a lot of points on this Jacobian, or doesn't actually find any solutions to the equation defining the curve. It's an interesting problem to do that. Okay, so in the remaining time, I'm going to explain one of these points, I think the second one. Let me just say a few words here. The first one is, how did Bjorn put this? No fundamental advances. This is a putting together of ideas that are known, but putting it together in an efficient way, a way which you can use it to sort of prove BSD for some explicit curves. If you know my work about elliptic curves at high rate, the basic idea there is what's happening here too, but it's been now made into a little bit more efficient machine. And this third point is actually the hardest part of the proof, but it's a technical issue. So Nick Katz, and I think just Nick Katz is sort of the world expert in proving that representations like this are large, and he's developed a lot of techniques, and if you sweat over his papers and think about it and do some work, you can prove things like this. So this is something that experts know how to do, and there's no fundamental advance here. But this is something I think that's quite new. So there's a machine based on this linear algebra limit that's hiding back here that produces L functions that vanish to higher order. And it produces them in many other contexts. So you can do it in this context, but I can give you tons of other situations of L functions vanishing to very, very high order at the center of their functional equation, maybe without being able to prove these other facts that sort of make it extra interesting.
So that, when you say bar, you mean it's not contained in any proper levy?
No, what I mean is that if we twist so that we really land inside SP, then it's Zariski dense.
It's Zariski dense. Well, you're
actually thinking. Yeah, the monochromy group is SP.
So this technique to prove the large image, they're specific to the covariance of curves, or they're for any leading varieties?
They're for any least sheaf on an open curve.
Right, so that typically what happens is you, you use some heavy theorems from Lie theory and then some explicit calculations of local monodromy at ramified points. Okay, so, but I want to explain number two because it's, if you're willing to take some cohomology theory as a black box, then it really boils down to that linear algebra, which maybe I should show again so that you can keep working on it if you forgot to prove it. So I want to sort of introduce a black box about computing L functions. Okay, so let's assume we have this row. I'm going to twist the F loop. I'm just going to twist out the wafer so that I really land inside here. You can ignore that if you're not familiar with that. So with a large image, and this I mean in a very mild sense, much milder than what we proved in the theorem, because with a large image, and satisfying some mild ramification conditions. I want to introduce a diagram of fields here. So I have, let me write down the equation of that curve that I had a second ago. So I said something, y squared equals x to the 2g plus 1 plus x to the 2g. Let me just put a u here. And I'll have the field fp of u. And I'll have its extension fp of t, where here u is t to the d of some d. Okay, so this is my original field K. This is also K. It's isomorphic to K, but I want to think of it as a different field. So I'm going to call this guy KD. Okay? And the way that this construction of large rank L functions works is to start with something which is defined down here and prove that when you restrict it to the Galois of this thing, you get something with a large order vanishing L function. Okay, so. So we have a row, a large image, and some mild ramification conditions. And I want to think about L. The L the way I define this thing is just dependent on the representation of rho. So I'll write L rho of S and L of rho D is where rho D is rho restricted to the Galois group. Okay, and for a well-chosen D with some other hypotheses, we get a large order vanishing for L function. Okay, so for this we need some black box here, which is computing L functions. Okay, so if you're given representation rho, some Galois group, K, some GL, and QL, then there are cohomology groups. H0 of rho. One of rho, two of rho. So these are finite dimensional vector spaces over QL with an action of the Galois group of the finite field. So Okay, which amounts to just a linear transformation on this thing. So I'm just asking you to accept the black box here. This is some L-adic cohomology theory. From the row, I make some sheaf somewhere, take some L-adic cohomology groups, and at the end of the day, I get three cohomology groups here, which are finite-dimensional vector spaces with an action of a Galois group of FP bar over FP. So this is the cohomology on C base change to FP bar, or some sheaf that's hooked up from row. Okay? And the statement is that for most rows, those that have large images, with a large image, this, I should say, maybe I can take up yarn's trick here with a big image. The big is a lot less than large. There's a very mild condition here, which is much less than having a dense in SPG, SP2G image. Anyway, so most of the time, H0 of rho and H2 of rho are equal to 0. And the L function, this infinite product, turned out to be something pretty small. Namely, it's just the characteristic polynomial of this Frobenius, so the p power Frobenius, the generator of that group there, acting on H1. Okay, so finite dimensional vector space operator here formed this sort of reverse characteristic polynomial with the q to the minus s in here. So this thing is a polynomial. So this is equal to a polynomial and q to the minus s. Okay, when you don't have these conditions, there's a denominator here that involves these two groups. They're typically one-dimensional and they're not zero. And this gives you back the statement, the analytic statements I made about this thing. Namely, this shows that this is an entire function of S, so polynomial q to the minus S, and the functional equation is a manifestation of some kind of duality here. Okay, so that's the black box, that you can compute L functions with this sort of cohomology theory. Okay, so let me go back to my diagram of fields. I have my original field for P of U, and then I have this extension KD, FT T, and here U is T to the D. And it's going to turn out to be quite important that this is not typically a Galois extension, because this group, the D through to unity, typically will not be an FP, so it'll be very far from it. So I have to deal with that, so I need to also introduce FP bar of U, or maybe some finite extension here, maybe FP bar of T. Okay, and I want to think about this calculation here of the L function. In that diagram fields. And the twisting that I made before, I'd like to change this just slightly. I want to put a q to the 1 minus s here. I'm looking for vanishing at s equals 1, and that means I'm looking for eigenvalue 1 of this linear operator after I've done this twisting. Okay, so I have my representation rho down here, and I can restrict it up here to rho d, and then I want to ask what happens to that group. And here's what happens. So h rho d is not to be equal to the direct sum over all I in d mod dz of h of my original rho twisted by some character. And here, the various chi to the i's, this is now a Galois extension. This is Galois with Galois group d through its of unity. And this z mod dz here is the dual group of this. So these chi to the i's here are the characters of the Galois group for this extension. So this is one of the formal properties of this cohomology theory. Basically, it's a projection formula. If you restrict here, then you can compute that in terms of first pushing down here, and that basically gives you the direct sum of all these twists. Okay, and I'm interested in how Frobenius acts on this thing. And if you think about this for a minute, you'll see that Frobenius permutes these spaces. So it sends h rho tensor phi I, not to itself, but to h rho tensor phi t. Okay, so the spaces are not preserved. I'd like to recollect them together so that there are some spaces that are preserved. So I'm going to write this as the direct sum over O and z mod dz, some group h1 rho tensor sigma O. What is O here? O is an orbit of multiplication by P on z mod dz. Okay, so I should have assumed here that my characteristic P is not divided by integer D here. So I can act on this group of characters by multiplication by D. And this guy is just
take row tensor chi 1, chi p, chi p squared until you get in a circle, collect all those guys together. That's one space now, which is acted on by Katrina's. Okay, and these are exactly indexed by the orbits of the action multiplication by p on this group. Okay, so I want to think about one of these guys at a time, so fix the orbit O. And I have this H1, well, so sigma O has a natural definition, but for now you can just take it to be the direct sum of the characters which appear in the orbit. So here, so this is the direct sum over I O. This is acted on by Frobenius, and this whole thing is acted on by Frobenius, but the spaces are permuted cyclically. Okay, so I'm starting to try to get set up to apply this piece of linear algebra and see what we need. So I have a vector space V, which is written as the sum of subspaces, and the indices here are I, times I, p squared times I, and so on, until I loop back so p to the something.
Sorry, what is sigma sub O?
You can just define it as the direct sum of the chi's as I and O. It has a natural definition. Let's just leave it at that. Okay, so p to the b minus 1, I, and then you come back p to the b, I equals I. Okay. So I want to impose some extra hypotheses to get the rest of the stuff that I need, and the rest of the hypotheses for this lemma here, and conclude that Frobenius has an eigenvalue 1 on this group. Okay, so that's my goal. Goal is to use the lemma for Frobenius to have eigenvalue 1 on one of these groups, H1, row, enter, sigma, row. Okay, and it'll turn out that when we figure out how to do that, it'll work for most of the orbits O. We'll have all the properties we need, and so we'll get a bunch of eigenvalues 1, and therefore a very high order of vanishing of the L function of S equals 1. Okay, so what do I need? I need the dimension of one of these spaces to be R. Okay, so dimension H1 row, answer I odd, imposes some mild ramification conditions. So I'll say something precise for the experts here. It's just so you can compute the dimension of this group in terms of the genus 0, or ground field K, and in terms of the conductor of this twisted thing. And here, this character is associated to this field extension of extracting roots. So it's ramified at 0 and infinity and nowhere else. So what you want here is that you want to take n prime. This is the conductor of rho without the part at 0 and infinity. And then this mild condition is that the degree of n prime plus the Swan conductor at 0 of rho, where C is the same thing, plus the Swan conductor at infinity of rho is R. Okay, so that's, if you want to sort of write down explicit equations, this is a fairly easy condition to arrange. If you wrote down something at random and this were even, you could just tweak the equation a little bit to introduce another place of bad reduction, where you have sort of a simple singularity and you change the pair here. Okay, so that's what you need for the dimension condition. What about the pairing? Well, pairing. The original guy we started with, rho, after some twisting, is self-dual. So this is the day pairing. Remember that rho is the action of gamma on torsion points in the Jacobian of our curve. There's a pairing on that. And that forces the action to be by GSP matrices, by symplectic similitudes. And when I do some twisting, I get just honestly symplectic matrices. So it's self-dual
with so inserted here some eclectic yourself doing. Okay. This implies that H1 in row is orthogonal self-dual. By the general machine, but H1 in row is not what I have. I have H1 in row twisted by these various characters. So it turns out that you have a pairing H1 row tensor phi I. H1 row tensor phi minus. Okay, and this thing eventually goes for a while, eventually rises to QL. Okay, so there's some Galois-Jordan pairing like that. So I need in this orbit, if I have chi to the I, I will also want to see chi to the minus I. Okay, so we want, this imposes on us that this orbit should be symmetric under negation. So this is the set of minus I's. Okay. And that leads to this condition that D has the form P to the N plus 1. Okay, because the orbit is I, P squared, I, so on. I'd like one of those numbers to be minus I. That means I want P to be congruent to minus 1 mod D. So D should at least be a divisor of something like this. So that's the reason for the exponents of this form in the explicit equation. Okay, so this says that some power of P is minus 1 mod D. Okay, and in the talk I'm giving now, this epsilon is going to be plus 1. So once you have arranged this, you have this pairing here, and it, when you do it on the whole space, it actually turns out to be symmetric pairing. So the sign here, epsilon equals 1. There are other contexts where the other sign is useful. Okay, this is automatic. Again, so I say that there's a pairing like this that's non-degenerate when the twisting is by I and minus I, and all the other pairings will be 0. Okay, so that gives us this. And then the last thing is an operator which permutes the spaces and respects the form. That's just for Frobenius. So you take G equals Frobenius, and you apply lem. I'm not writing linearly here anymore. I'm sorry. I haven't talked about this one. Okay, so it's a sketch, but that's the idea. So just to go back, so do I have it here that I can point out? No. Yeah, okay. So this is the representation that computes my L function on this field. And I've written it as a direct sum of factors like this. And when D is of a special form, and this ramification condition on rho is satisfied, each one of these orbits is each one of these spaces is something that fits into the framework of the lemma. It's got the pairing, it has the decomposition subspaces and the operator. So each one of these guys has a characteristic polynomial that's divisible by 1 minus t to the 2d. And that forces an eigenvalue of 1 with a multiplicity of 1. And you get 1 eigenvalue 1 for each factor here. And then the last thing you need to know is just to compute that there are a lot of factors here. But if you think about this, if d is p to the n plus 1, then most of the orbits have size 2n. P has order 2n mod d. In fact, that's the biggest they can be, and they're p to the n of them, so you have roughly p to the n over 2n zeros. If you work it out carefully, there are a couple of bad characters where the ramification conditions might fail. In the general setup, you'll get a rank that looks like p to the n over 2n minus some constant that's independent. Okay, so I think I've used up my time. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Proves that the analytic rank is high. How do you prove that the algebraic
rank is
high?
That's a whole other talk. I'll be happy to tell it to you prior, but that's a whole other hour.
So when you do this with a random curve, it's unlikely to have high rank. So what goes wrong with it? Is it because you don't have any odd dimensional?
I'm glad you asked it. So the story behind this is that I had done an example like this with genus 1 curves a few years ago, where you got high rank by extracting roots of T. And Jordan Ellenberg proved the theorem that under some hypotheses, this doesn't happen over Q of T. So if you write down the figure over Q of T with some conditions on it, then you prove that it does not have unbounded rank as you extract roots of T.
His proof used in a complicated way the representation theory of the Galois group, in particular this very non-abelian. And it breaks down completely over a finite field. So he wrote a message to me saying, do you think it's possible if you take any curve whatsoever, maybe known as isotrivial over FP of T, that it has high rank as you extract roots of T? And I wrote back immediately saying, that's ridiculous. Of course, exactly what you just said. For a typical curve, it shouldn't happen. And then I started to think about it a little bit more and woke up in the morning and realized that I actually already proven this when he asked me the question. I didn't realize it. I mean, this lemma, it was all already in a published paper. I just didn't know. It was a bad special case that I asked about in Durham. That question in Durham is a fallout of that. Anyway, so prove this, and now it's not so clear. You can see that you need all the hypotheses. Lemma's not true without any. You know, if you take away one hypothesis, it's wrong. So you're putting all this stuff in here, but maybe it happens anyway. It doesn't actually. It turns out you can give examples where the rank stays bounded, but you have to work pretty hard to do that. I mean, that's yet another hour. I think what's probably true is if you have a failure of this half the time when this curve is even, typically you'll get no additional rank as you extract roots of T. So I can prove that for a couple of concrete examples, and I expect that that's probably what's going on, but I have no idea how to prove anything that general.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks very much. The next talk is at 4 o'clock.
What happens to me when I'm
there? Elger just redid that as a cellular
curve. So just going up the tower.
In fact, this is non-Galois extension and ideas that are kind of like this.
Because I was thinking about keeping the genus on the genus would probably get
Q bar over Q. That's the extension Q bar T. In the same way that Parmenius was acting on this.
Yeah.
So